So in a second, it's going to say on air. You should see that. So again, this is just for you and me. And no one else is going to see the video of this. If you want to pick your nose or anything, just work away. That's fine. Okay, you ready to go?
Yep.
Cool. I suppose, like me, this week you watched the terrible news come out of Paris as we saw the cathedral at Notre Dame suffer that fire and bits of it start to fall down. And if you're a fundraiser like me, you probably watched the aftermath of that as people started to pledge money. People immediately started to give over hundreds of millions of euros pledging to help rebuild this. Fortuitously, on the side of that, I was scheduled to talk to my friend Paul Nazareth today. And this is a man who I'm hoping, I think he has a bit of a wealth of knowledge around fundraising for churches, fundraising for cathedrals. And I also have a feeling he might have a direct line to the big man upstairs. And so I welcome to the podcast today my good friend Paul Nazareth. Hello, Paul.
Hey there. Thanks for having me, Sam.
How are you doing today?
Doing very good.
Are
Chock
you?
full on a day like today, yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you're speaking to us from Toronto,
Yes.
Canada. So you don't say
Toronto.
Notre Dame, you say Notre Dame.
Not quite. That's a little American. We're half and half as expats here in Canada.
Yeah, you're a nice balance. And Paul, for I think a lot of people listening to this are going to know you because you're a man who knows people. But for those listeners who don't know you, who are you?
Well, been in a fundraiser for just a little under 20 years now, and in a unique way, been focused on legacy and planned giving for all of those 19 years. And so I've been fundraising for international charities, small and large universities, and I did spend just about a decade working in faith fundraising for churches, international mission. And my last role was with Canada's largest online charity, Canada Helps. That connected me to thousands upon thousands of churches and faith charities. So I have a very strong passion for that community, but I've worked with a number of different causes, education, healthcare, et cetera. And now I work with the plan giving community in Canada, coast to coast.
And you work with a lot of people in all of these roles. I mean, your name has come up on this podcast a couple of times. I refer to you often as the king of networking. Everything I learned about networking, I learned from you and Nikki Bell in the UK. But you have a wonderful habit of being open to people, of wanting to help people, and even through me, you've connected me with a lot of really interesting people. You take pride in that.
I do. And again, the networking thought is really that I struggled a lot in my early career, led a lot of fundraisers. We are thrown into some pretty crazy spaces, right? And to call important people, famous people, to be a connector in the community, and we don't get that training. And so I had a lot of insecurities in my first few years and was thrown into some big campaigns, one of them Canada's first billion-dollar fundraising campaign, and really needed to learn how to connect with people, how to connect with donors. And so I studied the mechanics of connecting, from everything from interpersonal connections with people to how to make those connections in an industry. It then allowed me to connect with more fundraisers and serve some amazing people coming up. So that's where it's been a real joy over the past decade or so, becoming a bit of a mechanic in human connection.
It's I mean your blog, you don't keep your blog up to date as much as maybe you used to, but you used to write a lot about networking. I attended one of your networking events where your people are actually walking along talking to each other. Networking has been good for your career. I take it, I gather.
Indeed, I mean, I went from a charity. I also spent a few years in a bank working in donor advised funds, and that became from networking to business development, working for advisors, working selling our products, but really being known as a connector for our topic, which was philanthropic planning. So it was, and I did a lot more in the early 2000s in blogging, even podcasting when it was quite new and had built up quite a big following. But you know what? I'll put it out there on the podcast. It's not one of the things that a lot of our employers support us as fundraisers to do. Today, an enlightened employer, one of the reasons I work where I do now, gets that your personal brand will only add to your ability as a fundraiser. But for many years, it was perpendicular to my work. And so the bigger it got, the more difficult my fundraising life got. And so now it's become a bit more of a balance. But it's been a struggle the whole way through. I was profiled once in a national newspaper, an article called how to build your social media presence and keep your day job. And then I got a call from one of our departments in the institution that said, hey, I just saw this article in this national paper. Don't be so sure you've kept your day job. Really good discussion about what personal brand means. And in the end, they said, actually, we really do like the way that you manage this. It is a perfect blend of professional and personal and adds to the work you do. But it is a delicate and confusing dance for a lot of people. So now it's a part of what I help even professionals navigate, from fundraisers, but to also lawyers and finance professionals, accountants. And it's an interesting part of what we do to advance charitable giving and philanthropy.
Yeah, I'm a big believer, although I'm not a big fan of the phrase personal brand. I'm a big believer, if you have yourself out there and good things happen to you and you make connections, it's good for the organization you're in. But I know a lot of people don't agree with that, don't get that. And you and I know, have mutual friends whose employer has told them to stop posting on social media, to stop speaking at conferences, and to stop putting themselves out there in a way that they think cannibalizes their own organization. They think it's a negative thing. They're not saying anything negative, but I think they think it detracts from the work they do.
It's one of the reasons why, as time goes on and work evolves, so many more people are finding their way into their own gigs, because it's just the dance becomes exhausting. You know, I always joke with people that one day I'll just end up at a hot dog stand, hot dogs, but then I'll start, you know, a blog and all those things that I want to do. But, you know, today too, we've got to work and find our way to employers that get that. And now, as part of my new life and role, I always make sure to put that as part of my negotiation with a potential employer and talk about what we do and how that brand will work. And being explicit has really helped, because now my current organization really gets it, supports me in that. Last night I was at a wonderful Association of Fundraising Professionals event, lifting up new speakers. It's called a Speaker Development Series. And it's really clear that the branding part is important, because again, as a fundraiser, we don't get the same type of interpersonal training that, say, financial advisors do, or the same type of presentation training that, say, marketing professionals do. But we will be thrown in front of a multi-million dollar business owner who asks for 6 or 7 figures. And you bet that connecting skills, presentation skills, speaking and influence skills will factor into that. And if you don't have any training, you're going to flub it. And that's just humiliating. Anybody, I think the networking enthusiasts are people who've been humiliated enough to say, I got to get better at this.
And you have gotten better at this. Oh my God. I mean, when I think of Congress, when I think of AFP Congress in Toronto, for me, it's always walking into that that big common area. And you always seem to be like the first face that greets me. You're like the host. It's not even your event. And you're kind of the host welcoming people in. And I just, I think a lot of people find that you're the friendly, recognizable face that connects people in our sector, especially over in Canada. And I love it. I love what you do.
Thank you. And it's really because those places have been home to me for so many years. I went to my first AFP Congress now just a little under 20 years ago, and I was very confused as a young fundraiser. Is this the right place for me? I was in between two very different worlds. I was working for a faith-based institution that really cared about those values and cared about giving and the connection to our donors, but did not care about fundraising, right? When I was introduced to the staff, it was almost an apology, saying, sorry, everybody, we've had to hire one of these people. We have to carry on our good work. But when I went to Congress, I found a community, I found a home, and now I'm really dedicated to making other people feel that way that it made me feel all those years ago, to say, wow, this is a profession. I've got a community that surrounds me. Those conferences are just, I joke with people, they're like a professional spa. And I just get filled up with energy and warmth and professionalism that will help me for the rest of the year while I'm out, like so many of us, alone very often doing what we do.
Yeah, I mean, fundraising can be a really lonely job, especially if you're working in a small organization, you're the only fundraiser, and it might only be once a year. If you don't make time, it might only be once a year you go to a conference like this and you're in a room full of people like you who have those same challenges, who feel that same loneliness. And it's refreshing. It's like you said, it's that spa treatment where you're ready to go back to work and face these people who are maybe embarrassed that they employ a fundraiser.
even in the big shops, you know, actually I was talking to a colleague in a university and they have a shop of 200 plus fundraisers, but a lot of them do different things: marketing, annual fund, leadership giving, direct mail, major giving. And in because of the silos, they also feel very lonely because they're always having to fight for their little element of fundraising. And everybody's fighting for position to say mine is the most important one and deserves budget, people, time, energy. Plus that fundraiser for this really big institution spends a lot of time on the road with donors. And as much as can be life-giving, every moment you're not with those donors, you're on your own, right? And you're doing the strategy and you're putting everything together. It's really, there's something to be said for gathering as peers and refilling those different pieces of not just energy, but knowledge. There's nothing more beautiful than seeing nerds, unbreakable nerds at a conference debating some really technical stuff, but you know that's going to advance their fundraising for the next year. So it's I just love those. I think debates are the newest, coolest thing we can be doing at conference.
Yeah, I do. We all enjoy watching a good debate. I want to ask a little bit more about your career in faith-based fundraising, but first I want to ask you about the stuff happening over in Paris. I've assumed you've been watching it like me. And from someone, you know, from a fundraiser point of view and someone whose faith is important to them, what's been your thoughts?
So, you know, there's a couple of things there. One is you know, it's been heartening to see the response from corporate and the donor community. Although what I'm seeing a lot online is this lamenting to say, oh, wow, you know, this happened 700 million in 24 hours. When we can't raise money for the human causes, for people and things like that. And I'm there. Again, I'm worked for the Catholic Church. I represented the Archdiocese of Toronto, which was 230 churches, 2 million people, for a number of years. I care deeply about the church, but I'm also the first to say, you bet these are buildings, right? And so that's where people are getting frustrated. But we have to remember that these institutions created these connections, cultivated these donors, and this is the coming back of that. The other part, though, is this really fundraising. A lot of those donors who are coming forward are at the 10, 20, $100 million plus level. I was reading an article this morning about two competing billionaires who hate each other. And they're competing through their pledges to Notre Dame. One pledged 100 million euros, and then the next day, the next pledged 200 million euros. So these are interesting major gift quarrels that a lot of us would love to have. But is it really fundraising? Is it that big communal grassroots groundswell campaign? I wouldn't say so. And actually, what I really think is positive is quite a number of people who have no time in their lives for regret or lament, I'm one of those, have gone and started campaigns for things they know are more important. So there are other churches in the southern United States that have burned down for causes and people, hunger, poverty, etc. They've actually bounced those campaigns off of the Notre Dame outreach to say, if you feel this way, if you're frustrated by this. And that's where fundraisers really win. When we connect to people's values and we really capture that action moment, right? Laura Fredericks and her famous book, The Ask, and she's really big as an AFP trainer on the concept of asking, is when we connect to the core. And the core is, what do you believe in? What is the cause you can't not support? And if people are not connecting with that, smart fundraisers have said, well, then what do you connect with?
There seems to be almost like two camps of fundraisers online in response to these big donations that are coming in for Notre Dame. There's the camp who kind of see us as competing causes. And like you're saying, you know, they're questioning why are you giving to this when there's such important human causes? So there's the camp that see it as all our causes are competing for the same pool. And I feel like perhaps there's a camp as well who feel like giving is good for the sector. So, you know, if you bring up philanthropy, if you can use giving to something that's not your cause, that it benefits all of us. What's the phrase? A rising tide floats all boats?
It is indeed. Oh, yeah. It's a big phrase. But it's more like, for me, I'm a big believer in abundance over scarcity. Again, a lot of people see this competition that there is a limited pie. And when we break down between the UK, the States, and Canada, when we look at a lot of the numbers, we see that donors in all different demographics are undergiving their in their capacity. There is absolutely capacity out there. And when we do more studies on donors connected to trust and to charities, we know that that's the eroded element. And what's telling us that is the things like the power of crowdfunding. Every time people tell me that there's no capacity, we see a crowdfunding campaign raise 1,000 times its goal. And it's not that it's super common, but the very fact that it happens whenever there's different tragedies is reminding us that when people are connected to the core of why they give, cause and human connection, they respond. And when we're not getting that kind of response, it's partly telling us that we're still off base with that, right? You know, those crowdfunding campaigns are images and videos connected to very current technology, and we're still writing dear friend letters in direct mail that's 5% dead people.
I mean, it makes you wonder, you know, these companies who've suddenly found 100 million to give to this, the billionaires who suddenly found 200 million, why were we, you know, why were other causes or other buildings or other pieces of art, why were they not able to tap into this? Why were they not able to tap into that money the day before this happened? The money was there. Why was our message so off?
You know, that's a tough one. And that's the major gift kind of conversation. Although I will say that a lot of these will probably come from different private foundations and different places where those kind of gifts are happening. And as we see the sector really reach another level with donor advised funds, with more professional private foundations and family offices, we are getting more insight that these things were already happening. They just weren't public. And that is absolutely the challenge of the sector, in that we do see the wealthy give to causes and things that are connected to the privilege that they represent. So that's the challenge. But as fundraisers, very often for community and grassroots causes, we've got to be asking more about the regular donor, about the everyday donor that actually makes up more of those dollars. Right? When we break up, we're blessed in the UK and Canada to have some good government numbers on receding and donor activity. That's where we've got to ask more stronger questions, because again, these things are black swan events. They're outlier events. It's about the really big shifts in the regular donor dollars. And we're seeing them in both our continents. We've really got to pay attention to these, right? In Canada, we're seeing, yes, donations are at a certain level, but given by less people. Again, tax receipted donations. We are not skipping to the next generation to help them understand what is charity, what is giving, what is donations. And again, that's why crowdfunding is surging, because we're not connecting to future generations. And one of the answers to that is as much technology as it is fundraising.
So you've been a successful fundraiser for a number of different organizations. What kind of feedback did you get from people when you were fundraising for churches? I mean, obviously, when you're fundraising for a church, it's much more than the building. But what was the mentality behind people who see the church as a place to give rather than, you know, curing some disease or feeding the starving or helping people come out of homeless? Where are those donors' heads at?
It's important to know that a lot of faith-based givers to churches and faith communities don't see those institutions as a traditional charity, for better or for worse. You know, that's the challenge sometimes too, is they really feel it is an extension of their home and their beliefs. They're taught within those systems. And frankly, churches and faith institutions are teaching giving, stewardship, fundraising a lot less than they used to. That's one of the big challenges. They just have a built-in mechanism in passing baskets and collection plates. It's part of the whole program. But actually, the ones that are doing this well are the ones that are teaching true stewardship, time, talent, treasure, that are teaching about giving. And for those donors who see it as a charity, frankly, their churches are also a framework, a prism to affect their values and the world as well. So they all do. All faith communities have a mission funds, disaster relief funds. They have a way to affect the world informed by their values. So there's a really strong community connection there, and people just want to see that element of their life continue. So that's the one thing that, when I worked in a lot of faith-based institutions, talk to those teams, it was about helping people realize that they can also give to that community in the same way they give to other charities. You know, that's the fuel for me of my whole career. I started in a faith institution my career started when I was sitting in a pew looking at a basket, thinking there's got to be a better way to do that. And that's how, frankly, one of the biggest charities in Canada was formed. Canada Helps, the team that I used to work with, was created by three nerd computer engineers who were teenagers who were just home for Christmas, and their mom forced them to go to church, and they looked at the basket and said, come on, man.
Yeah, and that's how Canada Helps came about.
They went into their basement and they consulted with another number of organizations and the revenue agency, but they built this website, these computer engineers, in response to looking at that basket and saying, you know, there's got to be a better way. And of course, that's all about year end, right? We were talking before about the fact that year end giving is a really big thing for faith institutions, partly because that's when all those faith celebrations are. It's also when everybody locks the door to their office. And then people put money in envelopes and shove them under the door, right? So this is the really odd part about these institutions, is that they have this built in, but they still haven't caught up to not just the technology, but the concepts of fundraising. And I have a problem with that. That's what really fuels my whole career. And we were talking about the image for the podcast, the Blues Brothers. I put out there, anybody who watched this movie, this is a movie about two Catholic fundraisers.
On a mission from God.
That's right. They come back from prison, and the nun who runs their orphanages said, we don't have enough money. You got to get out there and do a face-to-face major gift campaign. And the whole movie is shenanigans with them trying to raise this money to be able to hit the property taxes. So they're my good Catholic fundraising guys. They're grassroots and they're scrappy. You know, and they say, how can we do this? But unfortunately, of course, they default to a special event.
Yeah. Yeah. And they organize a good event. But they have those connections already. I mean, connections from before when they served their time in prison. They have the connections of good musicians and people like who's Ray Charles is in it. Yep. You know, they have those connections. That helps. That's major donor fundraising.
I guess so. But you know that what I get reminded too by a lot of my peers is, before I used to be a real special events hater, I've been a major in planned gifts for almost 20 years. We got to remember, though, that special events is that inspiration connection point, even for the major gift donors. So, you know, there's a place for all in the big tent of fundraising. It's the strategy that's really lacking. The pendulum swings from special events to major gifts to people trying to think that technology will save us. When you talk to tech people, they always think there's going to be an app that will save the world. Mm. Humans will save humans. And we've got to remember that technology is only about building a better bridge between people. And if crowdfunding and a lot of tech shows us that, it does. It's that crowdfunding is telling a better story and creating a more efficient connection between the person who felt something and giving them the ability to do something. That's the challenge. A lot of charities aren't up with that kind of tech to move people from feeling to doing fast enough. We have them at events, yeah, but then we tell them, write down your credit card number on this weird index card and throw it at us, and we'll process it over 3 weeks and maybe one day thank you. When you could do it right there, because every human being's got a phone in that room, and you could be thanking them and receiving them before they leave the building.
There's like a disjoint sometimes between the technology and the people who know technology. You know, they're really good at this method of giving. They can build these apps. They can build the tech that's going to make it really easy. But they never seem to have the conversations with the fundraisers who know the motivation. You know, and so the tech people sometimes make this mistake of thinking that app is the motivation. You know, if you make the app, people will come to it. Whereas the fundraisers know it's a lot harder to get people there, but they're struggling to grasp the technology.
Yeah, it's about making that human bridge. Right. I mean, that was my time at Canada Helps, was discovering. And when I was there, I walked in the door. We were about 12, 13 people doing 68 million. And about 11 months ago, when I moved on, the team is a little under 50, doing last year 183 million. But it was all about those different connections to people. You know, I call this one food bank. We said, what did you guys just do? You made like almost $40,000 in 8 minutes. Really small organization. And they said, you know, we run the special event and we have a silent auction. And we were really worried, saying, oh, you're not supposed to run silent auctions through online giving. You can't receive for that. They said, no. We realized how many people win an auction and how many people lose an auction. More people lose than win. Mm. So while we announce the winners and they're all paying for their auction items, we have their name, email address for the bidding. We just sent an email to everyone in the room that said, you came here to play. You brought the money to bid. You bid on this. You believe in us. You heard our story tonight. If you feel so moved, would you give? And they gave 3 times the amount the auction raised from that email instantly before they left the room. It was the human connection from their leaders, from their people who were affected by the mission, inspiring the donors. But they built the instant bridge onto those phones before they left the room to capture the emotion. And the people responded.
Where do churches go with the collection basket? How do they build that bridge? Because, I mean, the collection basket hasn't evolved as far as I know. I mean, I don't go to church as much as I used to. But I think the collection basket technology, I'm fascinated by it. It's the same thing it was. It just is. It's handed round. There's that bit of guilt compared to the person next to you. You want to try and kind of keep up with that. You always notice one big note in the basket, and you're wondering who's put that in. Where do we take that?
It's like a tip jar with the piano at the lounge. I often will tell them, you know, you're not using your assets of guilt and shame enough. And they laugh at that, but actually it's more that they're not using that communal element, you know, so the basket's going around. You know, there's a famous story about Henry Ford, the car maker, saying that if I asked my customers what they wanted, they would have said mechanized horses. I actually watch some congregations now trying to build digital tap tools for the basket to do direct transfers. There is a disconnect. And one of the disconnects is that as much as now quite a number of churches have evolved to a digital bank deposit, they still need to put something in the basket, right? Or you're going to get the stink eye from the person at the end of the pew who doesn't think you're giving. They forgot the human element as much as the digital element. So the smarter churches are now actually building in what's called a stewardship token or some sort of thing that you keep at the back of the church if you're on direct deposit, if you gave securities at the start of the year. You pick up one of these tokens, and when the basket comes around, you put it in.
Yeah.
And the churches say, oh my gosh, what if someone puts it in and they haven't given? And then we say, well, then you got more problems than we can help you with.
Yeah.
If you don't have trust, then what kind of community are you? But the ones who have really built it up in that true values-based stewardship way, that to understand the human participation, but also respecting. Again, this is not about asking. This is where I help a lot of them overcome their fear of fundraising and asking. This is about respecting your donor. They want to give. They need to make it affordable. It's 2019. Who carries around cash? If you can't make it easy for a bank deposit, for a debit transfer, for stocks and securities, or however that person wants to do it, because we got to remember that both our countries are now older than they are younger. And the largest demographic of donors hold their money in assets, not cash. And so that's where the basket has to evolve. I think in time, the basket will evolve to more of a communal gesture than it will just the cash connection. Because I tell them the worst sound you can hear is the clinking of change. That's the wrong kind of change. You want actual change that is donations. And that's even beyond bills.
That's interesting. You have a very interesting past, and I believe you crossed paths with the Pope before.
Well, you know that more as a young person at World Youth Day, but I worked for a regional franchise in Toronto, the Catholic Archdiocese of Toronto, the Central Church, largest grouping of churches in Canada, eighth largest in North America, 230 churches. I had 1.9 million donors. And that was a real challenge to scale this major in plan giving program to get to all these churches. I did tens of thousands of kilometers in 1 year, multiple weekends speaking off pulpits. It was really a big culture change of helping those communities understand your giving, your generous givers, we're grateful, but we need to adapt to respect you, right? We need to be there where you are. Again, who can carry that cash or put money in the envelopes? It's about adapting to bank deposit, securities, building a culture of that stewardship. Why do you care? What do you want to? So, you know, I had one donor who was giving quite generously, but then when we connected to them to what they cared about, they sang in the choir for 40 plus years. And when we talked about what they could do for the music ministry in that church, boom, their giving was transformed. They left a legacy. It was beautiful to make sure that the hymnals, the books for the musicians, are replaced every single year. Meanwhile, they'd replace them twice in 20 years. And every year they were replaced all the books in that church. And then they'll use the one-year-old books to give to another church in that diocese or that region.
Oh, nice.
And within how long, you're going to have a ton of churches actually replacing all their old books and things like that. And then they can even share them forward. That was just one kind of thing for their type of ministry. But in these church communities, you've got dozens of ministries around poverty, around community, between United and Anglican Church and their incredible outreach in Canada to poverty, to social justice, to social enterprise. United Church is doing incredible work around social enterprise. The Anglican Church of Canada is doing quite a bit of work in Canada towards Indigenous reconciliation. It's really been interesting over those years when I was with Canada Helps. And now as a faculty member, I teach planned giving to faith communities, getting to understand their connection to fundraising as well. And so now it's evolving to other communities. We're working with the Muslim Association of Canada on evolving a fundraising course for Muslim organizations and mosques.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Do you think that, what would you say if someone was to say perhaps the church already has too much money?
Those are often people who don't go to church. That's money hats and all the gold and all that stuff. But, you know, we have those honest conversations. In 2019, it's up to those churches to start having honest conversations with their people, their donors. I was sharing with you just a couple weekends ago in Canada, our public broadcaster was talking about how in Canada, 9,000 churches will blink out of existence in the next decade. And as a fundraiser, I have to say, that's on them. If they're not going to adapt there, they don't want to adapt how they fundraise, how they ask for money, how they accept money, how they respect their donors. And if those congregations won't have enough to survive, partly it's because they keep relying on the basket and not major in planned giving. In faith communities, their average bequest is really big, right? Because people will often leave. And of course, in Canada, to our demographics, is we have the most amount of people with the least amount of kids. So the average bequest amount is going up. There's so much potential there. But there's a lot of communities that just don't want to ask. They have this sensitivity saying, oh, we can't do that. But it's about responsibility. It's about respect as much as it is about fundraising. This is what people care about.
They've grown accustomed. I mean, has the church had it easy in that the money used to just come in? And now it's, you know, they actually have to work for it, the fundraisers, or they need fundraisers.
Yep. And again, changing demographics, changing areas and regions. A lot of those Christian communities have moved. And so they don't need physical churches in the same places they did. They're going to have to evolve around that. Right. And so that's the challenge for a lot of those institutions as well. And you're right. Organizations do get complacent. Things came in, but it's also that they're not adapting to the demographic of donor. You know, even in some of those communities, I was active in some very wealthy communities, but they are older now and they hold their money in assets. That's why planned giving is so important. In 2019, every major gift is a planned gift. We got a great colleague named Ed Sluga of PG Growth, who says that the largest planned giving consulting firm in Canada, who reminds us that today when someone's giving over five or six figures, they're giving it in securities. They're not giving you cash. Fewer people have checks than ever before. So we've actually got those institutions need to really realize that their donor base is there, their values haven't changed, but they're making it, the charity is making it harder and harder to support them. You know, we've just got to realize how donors live. In 2019, we live through our phones, this is the baby boomers down. And so you've got to be ready for our donors to be able to also give that way or connect that way as well.
You see, you're an active guy, you're a vocal guy. You know, you're kind of preaching this word of gift planning. You're the vice president of the Canadian Association of Gift Planners. So you're trying to get this kind of word out there for people to adapt, for people to evolve in the way the donors are evolving.
Yeah, again, it's just about that responsibility of meeting the donors where they are. This is a pretty recent move for me, and it was partly because I was a faculty for a number of years. I taught at a college there, taught for CGP. But the demographic time has come, right? Fraser Green, Good Works, wrote a book a decade ago called Iceberg Philanthropy about how planned giving was that the big part below the surface, but everybody keeps on focusing on the top part. Well, 2019, like everything else, the iceberg is melting. Those donors are here now. They are on the surface. The majority of donors are going to be giving in assets, and the majority of charities aren't willingly adapting to accept those assets or to talk to donors about that. And so, as usual, only the big charities will win. And that's where, again, plan giving is the ultimate democratization of fundraising. When it comes to major gifts, it's about who has the capacity to ask. But when it comes to plan giving, it's about who has the capacity to accept. And so that's where we're really trying to get that word out there to the medium and small charities. Just get up to basic speed on this. And the potential is really huge.
How do you find time for all this, Paul? You strike me as a very busy man. Do you work too hard?
No, you know what? I have really rebalanced over the past couple of years. Again, I used to be a full-time vice president of Canada Helps and faculty with a college and faculty with CGP teaching roles. And over the past couple of years, I've really aggressively rebalanced. I've got a young family and I'm a hyper planner. You know, my pastor of my church asked me at my wedding day, did you propose by PowerPoint? Because anyone with me knows that I have two clickers on my person at all times. But I said, no, there was an Excel spreadsheet. And so even for my fellow fundraisers, my greatest mentors are people who really plan well. They've become good. No, it's been really hard for me, especially as a speaker and an enthusiast for teaching and engaging people. It's really been about that planning. And now a lot of my work is as much listening and learning from communities as it is teaching. So that is why I love the travel so much. Because it takes me into communities where, yes, I'm doing a keynote, but for that 48 hours I'm in town, I'm meeting with charities, community foundations, churches, libraries, and listening to where giving is at, where their structure strategy is at, where their donors are at.
You're still as connected as ever. You seem to know everyone.
Context and connectedness are my... If you ever did Marcus Buckingham or the Gallup's Strength Finder, they have a Strength Finder 2.0, my kind of five big values are context, connectedness, community. That's where I get and gain strength, is knowing, you know, where everything's at and what can we change. I'm eternally hopeful about what we can change, that abundance over scarcity.
So if people listening to this want to connect with you, where's the best places to find you?
Well, so I always joke with people that LinkedIn is my real place of residence. Whenever they see me, it's really just a hologram. LinkedIn and Twitter definitely are places that I live to connect with fundraisers, right? And wonderfully enough, I'm all over the country on a regular basis, but the virtual is the way that I keep in touch the most. So LinkedIn and Twitter are probably the best ways. And that's the part, again, to connect and listen and serve and help people get better at what they do. It's less about personal branding and networking, more about being a sector connector, more about helping people that want to do good get better. My personal life mission is to help every individual I connect with find their purpose and do that for a living. Amplify their superpower. And if they need help finding it, I'm that magnifying glass.
And I can vouch for you, Paul. I mean, you're one of the most generous people in the sector. And you know, I never see you kind of looking for anything back from anyone.
Well, I'm in a new stage of life now after doing that for a decade plus. Part of it is being open to the generosity of accepting. You know, that's the part now where a lot of times where I need help in communities, we are trying to do something hard in plan giving. We are trying to activate a part of fundraising that is not easy, right? 90% of plan gifts are bequests. So you can make all of the brochures you want in the world. Our donors are looking at these brochures and saying to us with their donations, I choose death. What you are proposing is too complicated. I'm just going to die. we're not admitting that it's really working. And so as an organization, as a community, we're looking for those partners to help us. We're rejuvenating our faculty. We're looking for evangelizers in fundraising and plan giving. And now after 10 years plus of really aggressively giving, it's wonderful to have so many people on my doorstep saying, Paul, what can I do? And again, they're seeing the benefit in this because we're delivering. Plan giving is as much about major gifts as it is about anything else. So it helps. We're delivering cash money. Now all those contacts that I helped are all directors of fundraising. So that doesn't hurt. And it's also helpful to have a network that is able to do something together. You know, I'm building an army of light I'm trying to surround myself. That's a personal, selfish thing I do, is I'm just going to surround myself with people that are positive from this way going forward. And it's wonderful to now have assembled a pretty good network that way.
That's lovely. Yeah, I recommend anyone listening follow you. You're on Twitter as You Invited You. Paul Nazareth is on LinkedIn. Will I see you at Congress in November?
Indeed. Always there. Again, at Congress is that thing that that rejuvenates. So I'm always around for sure.
As always, welcoming people. Spot the pocket square. Spot the beard. Very easy to spot. All right. Listen, thanks a million for joining me, Paul. This has been really interesting. I appreciate you taking time. Such a hardworking guy, but actually carving out some time for me. It's been really nice to speak to you.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
We'll see you again soon.
Thanks.